The following hour of KDBS programming may not be suitable for all audiences, as it may contain material which may be perceived as objectionable. Parental discretion is advised. The views contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDBS, KDBS sponsors, or the University of California. So, let's get into it. Hope everybody is having a wonderful week. And for those who enjoyed a lovely Rosh Hashanah weekend. No. Okay. Good to know. Yeah. real quick, before I get straight into it, October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and Recology Davis would like to remind the women of our community to have screening mammograms at recommended intervals. Today's low-dose, state-of-the-art mammography can detect tumors too small to be discovered by touch. Don't delay, because early diagnosis means that you'll have a much greater chance of successful treatment. This important message is brought to you by Recology Davis. Online at recology.com, R-E-C-O-L-O-G-Y.com, Recology Davis cares about the health of the women in our community. And another sponsor, that was Recology Davis. Second sponsor, Naturewood Home Furnishings. Ooh, I like this one. Naturewood Home Furnishings, kind of like nature, except with no E, nature, no E, Wood Home Furnishings, reminds us that October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month and encourages women to get checkups. Early detection means you'll have a much greater chance of becoming a survivor. So don't delay. Test today. This message is a courtesy of Naturewood Home Furnishings at 12125-12125 Folsom Boulevard in Rancho Cordova. Online at naturewood.com. That is N-A-T-U-R-W-O-O-D.com. Naturewood Home Furnishings cares about the health of the women in our community. Awesome. So, as I was saying, hope everybody had a wonderful, wonderful Rosh Hashanah. And, you know, it's really, you know, important. I should announce as well, you're listening to Lazy Lazzy's Thinking Thoughts show. I'm thinking too many thoughts, getting a little ahead of myself. You know, it's really important to reflect on not just what, you know, where we are in the world, but also to look back a little bit, It's a very, let's just say, intense year. It's been an intense year. And I want to read a bit about justification and what are justifications used to announce, to state. Specifically, I want to talk about history involving the villages of Lydda and Ramla, two Palestinian villages that met their end in 1948. Now, this follows after the Peel Commission, later the UN Commission, dividing Palestine among a larger land area offered to Israel. Now, there was some hope that Lydda and Ramla would be spared by the encroachment of Israelis. That is, until the Air Force, the IDF Air Force, began its operation, namely its Operation, what is this? Plan Dalit. On the day of the bombings of Ramla, as quoted by Dani HQ headquarters to IDF General Staff in 1948, a general and serious flight from Ramla. There's great value in the bombings. For those who were on the ground at the time, those soldiers, unnamed, Gideon, trooper of the 89th Commando Battalion, I kill everyone who belongs to the camp, man, women, old person, child, and I am not deterred. This removal, namely in a concern of the then Zionists, a transfer, was reported by Keith Wheeler on his Battlefield report as practically everything that got into their way died, referring to the IDF, riddled corpses laid by the roadside. To, of course, separate the people from their land, from the villages of Ramla and of Lid. Of course, reducing a conflict to its embodiments, to the state, is a way to smooth out certain incongruities in a message. It cannot ignore the lifeless bodies of men, women, and children who have died in Ramla and Lid, the unnameable Palestinians. These corpses, of course, for the IDF, posed a political problem and a moral and aesthetic issue, both reports of the time by IDF commanders. There was justification, retroactive. The standard lies that Arab broadcasts sent from the Arab High Committee and national committees of Arab cities, such as Damascus and Cairo, were transmitted to the citizens of the area to, quote, make way for the advancing Arab armies, is used as a retroactive justification for the encroachment and active removal. I will use again this word return, and I should say this will come up later. Active removal of the Palestinians, and in conflict with, of course, the reality, the recorded history and direction that Cairo and other Arab countries had explicitly stated and acted, in fact, in preventing those that were supposedly broadcasted to from coming over their borders. Of course, this detail is still shared, this idea of Arab broadcasts, still given as a standard report, despite history's contrast. It's a form of historical revisionism, of course, which not only runs counter to the actual history, but serves as a perceived hostility to blind Israelis to their own history. By one historian, let's see this guy's name. I want to ensure that those listening have proper names of these historians and of these figures. Christopher Hedges? Possibly Christopher Hitchens. Of course, this lie being repeated was that the figure Haj Amin Husseini called upon the Arabs to leave in view of the invasion of the Arab armed forces in 1948. This brought the first disaster on the Palestinians and created the Palestinian refugee problem, stands as the official Israeli position on these matters. Notice the placement of blame in those who were made to be removed. Oop, let's make sure that my microphone is still working. Okay. Not the aggressors who removed these people at first. To quote Voltaire, anyone who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And in these atrocities, Regardless of planned actions by the Palestinians, there is no doubt that the IDF intended the removal of settled people. In their own words, in fact, these people were to be expelled in a most deliberate and timely manner. Deir Yassin was doomed to be wiped out because it was within the areas designated in Plan Dalit to be cleansed. This dream of expansion requires removal. Land predicates, land comes with people. Those people must be separated from their land. At the time, 1947, Zionists did not accept the terms of the Peel Commission, a British royal mandate, which was seen as a, disgraceful partition by the Zionists. But they only publicly stated an acceptance. The Zionist leadership saw any Jewish state as the first step in the aims of conquering Palestine. The existing people were considered no more than mere obstacles, objectives in need of physical removal and completion. This was observed and noted by British mediators, should be said, such as British Foreign Office Eastern Department head George Rendell in 1938. It has been clear that partition will not mean what we first imagined, a separation of the Jewish and Arab spheres, but will mean the creation of a new jumping-off place for the Jews, from which they will inevitably spread their influence over a much larger area. The Jews make no secret of this, and it has become clear that it is the main objection of the Arabs to the partition proposals. This motive was not so much observed as it was blatantly stated by Ben Gurion, the national founder and first prime minister of Israel. From Ben Gurion, "I favor partition of the country because when we become a strong power after the establishment of the state, we will abolish partition and spread throughout all of Palestine." A blatant admission, to be sure. These intentions, again enunciated in, by the 1947 partition, "We have not come to an empty land to inherit it, but we have come to conquer a country from a people inhabiting it." Of course, that was Moshe Shertak, Ben-Gurion's chief aide and the first foreign minister of Israel. Another blatant admission of Israel's intention, Zionists' project. Early Zionists were quite aware of the existing population of Palestine. Acknowledged as early as 1905 by Israel Zengwill, one of those early Zionists, and close lieutenant to Theodor Herzl, another founding father for Zionists, Palestine proper had already its inhabitants. The province of Jerusalem is already twice as thickly populated as the United States, having 52 souls to the square mile and not 25% of them Jews. Another statement, Chaim Weizmann, Israel's first president, himself acknowledged the native population of Palestinians in a comment to Arthur Rupin, head of the colonization department at the Jewish agency. "The British told us there are some 100,000, this word, of course, is, I'm specifying this word just because, to be certain, this is a racially charged word, kushim, or generally referring to a Palestinian inhabitant of African descent, I believe. And for those, there's no value." That was, of course, in 1914. The transfer, or removal, was seen as the agreed-upon solution by early Zionists. By Ben-Gurion's 1947 diary, excitedly, he wrote, "The compulsory transfer of the Arabs from the valleys of the proposed Jewish state could give us something which we had never had an opportunity that we never dared to dream of in our wildest imaginings, national consolidation in an independent homeland." Again, Ben-Gurion, "I support compulsory transfer. I don't see in it anything immoral." At the protocol of the joint meeting of the JAE and the Political Committee of the Zionist Actions Committee, "If there are other inhabitants there, they must be transferred to some other place. We must take over the land. We have a greater and a nobler ideal than preserving several hundred thousands of Arab fellahin Fellahin, translating to peasant or farmer. That was Menachem's Ussishkin. I may be mispronouncing that, Jewish National Fund president in 1930. From Nur Masala's The Bible and Zionism, another report from 1948, perhaps the most consistent, extreme, and obsessive advocate of compulsory transfer was Yosef Weitz, a Polish Jew who arrived in Palestine in 1908 and later became director of the Settlement Department of the Jewish National Fund, JNF, and head of the Israeli government's official transfer committee. Transfer, I again stress the use of the word. Weitz, a prolific diarist, wrote later in December of 1940 back that there is no way but to transfer the Arabs from here to the neighboring countries, to transfer all of them. Not one village must be left, not one Bedouin tribe. The transfer must be directed at Iraq, Syria, and even Transjordan. And only after this transfer will the country be able to absorb millions of our brothers. There is no other solution. To the standard lie, that of the, I will say, economical Zionist, that those who occupied the lands prior to the colonization of Israel produced naught but subsistence, and that the Zionists brought a tamed nature to these lands, Weitz himself described, upon visiting central Palestine in 1941, large villages crowded in population and surrounded by cultivated land growing olives, grapes, figs, sesame, and maize fields, a settled people, a existing people. Of course, to return to the 1948 resolution, both disliked by Zionists and the Arab population, who saw any Jewish state with a lack of a Palestinian state as leading to further Jewish expansion, the dissatisfaction with the resolution may come as a surprise. The Zionist dissatisfaction may come as a surprise when the total land area given to the Israeli people was in all 56% of the total land area of Palestine, of which, at the time prior, only 6% was controlled by the Israeli people. Of course, if an equal reapportionment along the ratio of population was instead demanded, only a tenth of the total land area would be required to do. This dissatisfaction, likely due to the fact that it was only a portion of the total land. The demands of transfer stemmed from the logic of Zionism, entailing occupied land, which required the removal of its people, the removal of the people from their land. From Benny Morris, a Israeli historian, transfer was inevitable and inbuilt into Zionism because it sought to transform a land which was Arab to a Jewish state. The UN partition sliced Palestine into its two lopsided sides. From Menachem Begin, the Ergin commander, my greatest worry in those months was that the Arabs might accept the United Nations plan. Again, dissatisfaction at a 56%, far greater than the tenth of equal reapportionment, ignoring, of course, the existing settled people. Ben-Gurion reassured such eager desires and stated that he would make it clear to his cabinet that he had no intentions of respecting the boundaries indicated in the partition resolution. From Ben-Gurion, United Nations resolutions are not compulsory, and we ought not to pin all our hopes and efforts on them. Let's see. Reported in its time. I wish I didn't only have a cut-off version of this quote, but of the reaction by the Arab population following this partition. To begin a bit further, this was from, Alan Cunningham, I believe. Let me sure that was his name. Yes, former High Commissioner of Palestine, assigned by the British, that the initial protests were spontaneous and unorganized by the Arab Palestinian population, and were more demonstrations of displeasure at the UN decision than determined attacks on Jews. The weapons initially employed were sticks and stones. Had it not been for Jewish recourse to firearms, it is not impossible that the excitement would have subsided and little loss of life been caused. This is more probable since there is reliable evidence that the Arab Higher Committee as a whole and the Mufti in particular, although pleased at the strong response to the strike call, were not in favor of serious outbreaks. A state does not secure its existence through rights, but through violence. This violence was precipitated by and demanded of by the Israeli settler project. Land is taken, land has been taken, and land, well, as we are seeing now, will continue to be taken, barring any action on the part of those supporting. Now, I want to return again to the justifications used to defend the Israeli Zionist settler project. Because in this justification, we find I don't want to say paradox, but rather a conundrum of sorts. One of accepting that if one believes a people are to be discriminated upon by ethnicity, then to what lengths are you willing, as a state willing, to go to, well, enforce this? What level of violence follows from this inherent ideology of the Zionist project that those of the brought over Jewish people, the settled Israeli people, well, I should say the forcefully settled Israeli people, and those that prior existed, the resettled Palestinian people, that in this ideology there is an implicit statement that a Jewish life is worth more than a Palestinian life, that an Israeli life is worth more than a Palestinian life. I also want to draw attention to the way in which both the Palestinians are discussed and the supposed right to exist of an Israeli state is put forth. Of course, this, going to justification again, belief that a Israeli state, a state, is required in order to protect a people requires the formation of a state. And, as I said, a state does not secure its existence through rights, but through violence. I want to leave today on a quote I heard from Ta-Nehisi Coates, an author I've read before, and one that I'm eager to read again, and his most recent title, The Message. It's a three-part, or it's a book with three essays. Let me read a nice description. I want to find a nice, clear description. In his keenly anticipated new book, The Message, he explores the urgent question of how our stories, our reporting, imaginative story narratives, and myth-making both expose and distort our realities. Traveling to three resonant sites of conflict, he illuminates how the stories we tell, as well as the ones we don't, work to shape us. I believe that the shaping of stories surrounding the myth of Israel, the justifications of Israel, has shaped both the Israeli people and has been used as a tool to produce justifications. This quote of Ta-Nehisi, spoken at a live interview and discussion of his book, The Message, states, I'll read it and I'll go off of after. "I'm against a state that discriminates against people on the basis of ethnicity. I'm against that. There is nothing the Palestinians could do that would make that okay for me. Nothing." This is, of course, in reference to an ethnicity, to judgments of ethnicity, to immutable. Tangible existence. The Palestinian people exist. Jewish people exist. Israel, well, to return, I state, justifications bend and warp our reality. This has been Lazy Lazy on Thinking Thoughts. I appreciate you for joining me on this heavier topic. It has been a heavy past year. I hope that you are, if for those of you listening, if interested, feel free to join me at my next show. Well, two shows. Next week, Wednesday, 4 to 6 a.m., my music show, Hyperfixation Station. Planning on doing a bit of a more metal focused show. I think it'll be a nice way to wake myself up that morning and, you know, just get amped for the day. And if also interested, please feel free to join again. Next Thinking Thoughts show in 2 weeks, that is Tuesday, 4:30 p.m. This is KDVS 90.3 FM. Next we have
Radio Theater.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I'm excited for that. And yeah, this is Michael signing off. Let's see about get some fun sign off jams. All right. Normalization, what am I thinking? Immunization, power conditioning. Nothing is normal. Manipulated in believing. I'm exercising skepticism. Honesty is everything. Normalization, process reality. Immunization of what goes on.
Prefab experience, immunization, perceived autonomy.
This is KDVS Radio Theater. This week's episode is called The Girl on the White Horse. Tonight's play concerns obsessive adolescent infatuation, the psychology of personality cult politics, and the strange enigmatic death of German Green founder party Petra Kelly. This play is performed by Janie Lozano and Robin Fox. This program runs 53 minutes and 48 seconds, and we will play it right after we listen to some Carts.
Howdy. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis.
Whoa.
The moment my son saw a redwood tree.
It's huge!
Is the moment I knew that for him.
You can't even see the top of that thing.
Even the sky has no limit.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go. Your moment is out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
As the weather warms up and mosquitoes begin to appear, Americans are concerned about West Nile virus. However, few are somewhat familiar with the symptoms, and even fewer know how to protect against the disease. Symptoms of West Nile may include headache, fever, body aches, skin rash, disorder.